This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
India's total coronavirus cases surpasses the 20 million mark amid a severe shortage of medical supplies and overwhelmed hospitals. At least 23 people have died and dozens injured after Mexico City Metro overpass partially collapsed onto a road. Plus, Black Lives Matter activists call for an end to racism in the U.S. during a funeral for a black man killed by a white officer. Thanks for joining us. India's total COVID infections have soared past 20 million after it reported more than 357,000 new cases in the past 24 hours. India's caseload is the second largest in the world after the U.S. India is facing a deadly second wave of the disaster after the virus surged in the past few weeks. The government has been reluctant to impose a national lockdown due to the economic fallout. Opposition leader Rahul Gandhi says that the government's inaction is killing people and has called for the lockdown. The virus surge has caused severe shortages of medicines and oxygen supplies. Hospitals have been overstretched. A number of countries have already sent aid to India to help it contain its health crisis. Manavar Zaman says the Indian government had ignored medical experts' warnings about the ongoing wave of COVID-19 there.
Many cases are going unreported because there's a lot of queues outside the crematoriums, and there are not just people who die in the hospitals. There are many people who die in home quarantine, and they are not being registered in the government data. So we cannot trust the data completely that the government is giving us. So we just have to wait for proper data tonight. If the government comes with latest figures, then I've spoken with many experts either. They're saying that the government's failure also to avoid the crisis is one of the biggest problems that this country is facing, because many scientists in the month of January has warned the Indian government that the second wave would be disastrous and it would be much dangerous than the first wave. But the report said the government has ignored those scientists as well.
Pakistan's relations with the European Union have soured after European Parliament called for reviewing a trade deal which provides additional trade benefits to Pakistan. At the heart of the tense relations are rising anti-French sentiments and growing public demand to expel the French ambassador from Pakistan over repeated incidents of blasphemy committed against Muslim Prophet Muhammad in France. Javed Rana has more from Islamabad.
Pakistan's federal parliament in Islamabad, the lower house of the parliament, is preparing to resume a debate on whether or not to expel French ambassador over a repeated incident of blasphemy in France against Islam's last prophet Muhammad. However, days before the resumption of parliamentary debate here, the European Union Parliament has come up with what appears to be counter-resolution to pressurize Islamabad to prevent the expulsion of French envoy from Pakistan. The European Parliament has decided to review with Pakistan our trade agreement known as Generalized System of Preferential Plus or GPS Plus over what it calls a rising anti-French sentiments and mistreatment of minorities under blasphemy laws in Pakistan. Under this trade deal, Islamabad gets an estimated annual additional $1.5 billion trade benefits, which are far less than the economic losses Pakistan suffers almost every year because of mass unrest linked with Islamophobia in France. The frequent incidents of blasphemy in France has led to mass unrest across Pakistan.
The European Union is putting pressure on Pakistan, and they want them to weigh and to see whether this decision of expelling the French ambassador from Pakistan, will the government of Pakistan, will the people of Pakistan pay the price? Are they ready?
European Union's concerns go much beyond possibly expelling French ambassador.
Prime Minister Khan has crossed the Rubicon. EU policy towards countries that enable Islamic extremism must be resolute. Withdraw Pakistan's GSP Plus status now.
In an official reaction, Islamabad expressed disappointment with the European Union, pointing out that it reflects a lack of understanding in the context of blasphemy and associated religious sensitivities in Pakistan and elsewhere in the Muslim world.
None of the convicts of the blasphemy law was ever executed in Pakistan after successful governments and superior judiciary allegedly buckled under pressure to set convicts free and led them to migrate and settle in Europe. This has led to lynching of 75 under trial prisoners and suspects amid reports of misuse of blasphemy law in isolated cases since 1987 onwards. Javed Rana, Islamabad.
The train overpass has collapsed in the Mexican capital, Mexico City, killing 20 people, including children. The incident happened on Monday night. Mexico City's mayor says 70 people were also injured. Most of them are hospitalized. She says an investigation is underway to find the cause of the accident. The railway overpass collapsed onto a busy road while a metro train was passing. Firefighters and other rescue workers have suspended search for potential survivors. That's due to concerns that more of the overpass and train cars could slam down onto the road. New protests have been held in Colombia's capital, Bogota, after deadly demonstrations against a proposed government tax reform. Protesters marched in Bogota despite military presence. Truck drivers also blocked access roads to several locations in Colombia to protest the government's economic policies. Colombia has witnessed protests against the government's proposed tax reform for a week now. The rallies have continued even after the government withdrew its plan on Sunday. Anger has also boiled over the killing of 19 people and clashes with security forces during the protests. Hundreds more were injured in the clashes. Colombia is grappling with an economic crisis amid the pandemic. American civil rights activist Al Sharpton has called for an end to racism in the country, urging lawmakers to take action to stop racial profiling.
This must stop. Enough is enough. How many funerals do we have to have before we tell the Congress and the Senate that you've got to do something in these times?
Sharpton was addressing people taking part in a funeral ceremony of Andrew Brown, an African-American killed by police. Sharpton called on law enforcement officials to release the whole tape of the police encounter with Brown. 42-year-old Brown was fatally shot during a morning raid at his home on April 21st, when local sheriff's deputies tried to serve him with search and arrest warrants. His killing in mysterious circumstances has captured national attention. The U.S. has been the scene of mass anti-racism protests following the death of African-American George Floyd at the hands of a white officer last year. Former U.S. federal officer Matthew Fox says the growing anti-police sentiments in the U.S. could bring change concerning how the killing of African-Americans is handled.
But again, I think today we've seen something we've never seen before. The fact that I think we have the pandemic and more people had time to come out to watch these things, to see videos, to get out, to get involved. I think it has changed the sentiment of the country. I think you will see other officers get convicted, but the bottom line is, it's very tough to do that in the United States. But now that the sentiment is changing and that everybody seems to now beginning to put this thing on the front burner, we've got the video cameras that are now really the game changers, so to speak. So I think what you're going to start seeing is more convictions, or more people will start to just, plead out. But the bottom line is there's a change taking place. Now, we've got the George Floyd Protection Act in Congress that was passed through the House of Representatives. It's going to be a little battle in the Senate, but it's a chance that bill is going to get passed, and that's going to bring a whole lot more accountability and transparency to law enforcement. So I can see changes coming.
Welcome back. The European Union's foreign policy chief has stressed the need to seize the opportunity to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. In a tweet, Josep Borrell said that he has highlighted the importance of the U.S. return to the deal and its full implementation during the first ministerial meeting of the G7. The remaining signatories to the deal have been meeting in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to find ways to salvage the nuclear accord. While substantial progress has been made in the talks, diplomats say differences still persist. Iran says it will return to full compliance with the deal only after all U.S. sanctions against Tehran are removed in a verifiable manner. Iran has once again reiterated that the U.S. should remove all sanctions it imposed, reimposed, or relabeled after leaving the 2015 nuclear deal before the Islamic Republic accepts results of the ongoing talks in Vienna. Salman Khajuri has more.
Iran says substantial progress has been made in several rounds of Vienna talks between Iran and their remaining signatories to the JCPOA. Speaking at an online press conference, Iran's foreign ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh told reporters the Islamic Republic of Iran wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the nuclear deal.
The negotiators have come up with two drafts so far, but there are still differences that need to be discussed. The Islamic Republic wants the removal of all sanctions on the basis of what had been agreed upon in the JCPOA. Iran would verify the sanctions removal since those measures have deprived Iran of its JCPOA benefits. The remaining parties engaged in Vienna talks are also concentrating on the way the U.S. could return to the deal.
Regarding the statements by Iran's top negotiator in Vienna, Abbas Araghchi, who suggested that a list of sanctions on individuals and on Iran's energy, auto, financial, insurance, and port sectors have been agreed to be lifted, the foreign ministry spokesman said all sanctions under different labels should be lifted.
A red line is that all sanctions reimposed and those imposed under different labels must be lifted. There has been agreement on many issues, but there are also disagreements. Developments are significant and good, but it's slow in some areas.
Officially known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the nuclear deal has survived almost 3 years of unilateral U.S. sanctions on Iran since the former U.S. administration discarded the accord in 2018. Iran, in return, reduced its own commitments as a tit-for-tat by adopting a stepwise suspension of its nuclear commitments. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna to discuss how the U.S. should return to the JCPOA.
The Iranian officials say the path is clear. The U.S. must terminate all its anti-Iran sanctions before Tehran returns to full compliance. Otherwise, Iran will simply quit the talks.
The presidential mandate for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to form a new cabinet will expire at midnight after an inconclusive election. Media reports suggest that President Rivlin will probably choose opposition leader Yair Lapid for the task instead of extending Netanyahu's mandate. Lapid has said that he will offer Naftali Bennett, the leader of the right-wing Yamina alliance, a power-sharing agreement. Under the proposal, Bennett will first serve as prime minister for 2 years and 3 months, and then Lapid will take over. Israel has held 4 inconclusive elections in 2 years. The last one in March saw no parties winning a majority in the 120-member parliament. Netanyahu's right-wing Likud party secured only 30 seats, and he failed to secure support from other parties to reach a 61-seat majority. Journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip have marked World Press Freedom Day. The international occasion is very important for Palestinian journalists who often get attacked by Israeli soldiers in a clear violation of their right to cover the news. Rashef Shannon has more.
Palestinian journalists in the blockaded Gaza Strip held a sit-in to mark World Press Freedom Day. World Press Freedom Day is observed annually around the globe on the 3rd of May as a reminder that freedom of the press is a fundamental human right. Israeli forces killed and injured hundreds of Palestinian journalists over the past 2 decades and haven't been held accountable for their crimes. Currently, 16 Palestinian journalists are being held in Israeli jails, including 4 under administrative detention. During a press conference, the Palestinian Journalist Syndicate demanded an end to Israel's impunity.
Palestinian journalists are subjected to Israeli aggression, including killings and arrests almost every day, whether while they are covering the news or even inside their workplaces. Journalists are constantly threatened by Israeli forces. Such Israeli attacks and threats amount to war crimes, and we have reported these crimes to the International Criminal Court.
Israeli violence against journalists includes physical and verbal assault, as well as degrading treatment. Observers say the Israeli regime forces aim to keep journalists and mass media away from covering their crimes.
The silence of the international organizations has encouraged Israeli forces to further violate the rights of Palestinian journalists. All international press unions and syndicates must stand by Palestinian journalists and exert pressure on Israel to stop its immoral and illegal practices against journalists.
Israeli forces attacked several Palestinian media offices during the last 3 wars on the Gaza Strip. Since the beginning of 2020, Israeli forces carried out over 200 attacks against Palestinian journalists.
Over the past 4 months, Israeli forces carried out more than 217 violations against Palestinian journalists and media offices throughout the Palestinian territories. The attacks happened despite the protection that journalists enjoy under international law. It's crystal clear that Israeli attacks on Palestinian journalists are deliberate and systematic.
Experts say Israeli forces will continue with their violations against journalists as long as the international community keeps turning a blind eye.
On World Press Freedom Day, journalists demand international protection. Palestinian journalists risk their lives on a daily basis to cover the news and expose the brutality of the Israeli regime. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as you know, the night of Qadr or ordainment is very important among Muslims as it is a time in which our affairs are designated for 1 year. That's why it is also called the night of destiny. According to the Noble Quran, the night of Qadr is better than 1,000 nights. Considering the lofty status of this night, we are going to dwell upon the issue on the basis of the views of Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Stay tuned, please. The Noble Quran has used the word Qadr in 3 meanings. The first meaning of Qadr is measurement. The end of Ayah 3 of Surah Talaq reads, Certainly, Allah has set a measure for everything. The second meaning of Qadr is value and status. The beginning of Ayah 91 of Surah An'am reads, "They did not regard Allah with the regard due to Him." The third meaning of Qadr is the Quran. In part of Ayah 7 of Surah Talaq, we read, "And let he whose provision has been tightened spend out of what Allah has given him." There are differences among ulama and exegetes of the Noble Quran on the meaning of the word Qadr in Laylatul Qadr. Imam Khomeini, in his book Adab al-Salat or Codes of Ritual Prayer, writes, "Some ulama maintain that since the high positioned Quran has been sent down to the high positioned prophet by the high positioned king to the high positioned Ummah, this night has been called Laylatul Qadr. Some say that it is called so because the affairs, destinies, and the sustenance of people are determined on this night. Others are of the opinion that it is called so because of the ample number of angels on earth, so that they are pressed for the space." Dear friends, the Noble Quran has mentioned some features for the night of Qadr. Firstly, it is the night of sending down the Quran. Secondly, it is so grand and lofty that the servants cannot understand its value. Thirdly, it is better than 1,000 nights. Fourthly, the angels and Ruh, that is the greatest angel, descend to the earth with God's permission. And fifthly, it is peace till dawn. In other words, the divine mercy, forgiveness, and blessings pour down upon servants throughout this night. Imam Khomeini says on the characteristics and status of the blessed month of Ramadan and the night of Qadr, "The month of Ramadan is a blessed month, maybe because in this month, the Wali Azam, that is the great authority which is the messenger of God, has reached the loftiest position and, after reaching there, has caused the angels and the Quran to descend. It is by his power that the angels and the Quran are sent down. On this night, the Wali Azam attains the reality of the Quran and then causes it to come down to the point that he says it to the people. It means that the Quran is a mystery between God and the great authority who is the messenger of God. And the Quran is sent down after him to the point that it gets the form of words and a script so that we also make little use of it. It is not known exactly when the night of Qadr is. Some Sunni scholars believe that it is not known at all on which night of the year it falls, although it was in the month of Ramadan in the time of the Prophet. Other Sunni scholars maintain that it is on the eve of the 27th of Ramadan, but Shia ulama are of the opinion that the night of Qadr is on one of the eves of the 19th, 21st, and 23rd of the blessed month of Ramadan, though the 23rd is more likely. Some of the Shia ulama believe that the 19th night is the time of determination, the 21st is the time of ratification, and the 23rd is the time of signing and finalizing of the affairs of 1 year. Imam Khomeini was among these ulama. Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, used to spend the night of Qadr in prayer, supplication, and worship. he would close his meetings during Ramadan to spend his hours in recitation of the Quran and prayer. According to the companions of the Imam, he would spend more time in prayer and supplication on this night, although he used to pray and supplicate at midnight throughout the year. Imam Khomeini used to go to sleep at 10 p.m. On the night of Qadr too, he would go to sleep at 10, but he would wake up earlier to have more time for prayer and supplication. One of the guards of Imam Khomeini said, "Once on the night of Qadr, I was with the Imam. There was only a curtain between me and him. We used to avoid disturbing him. And the Imam used to supplicate in a way so that he wouldn't disturb anyone. He would supplicate in a very low voice. However, we would wake up with the sound of the Imam's crying. He used to recite the Quran and supplications. He used to recite Abu Hamza's supplication too."
What country's foreign policy is determined by the higher echelons of the political ladder, possibly all the way to the top, and not by the foreign ministry of the country? That was one of the points that Iran's leader made in his most recent speech. This was in reference to some derogatory remarks that were leaked in an audio file which went against the views held on Iran's foreign policy. The good force of the country's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the IRGC, and the force's martyred commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani. That's the subject of this edition of the debate. Let me introduce our guest. University professor and political analyst Fuad Izadi joins us. We also have political analyst Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, who also joins us. Welcome to you both, gentlemen. Fuad Izadi, let me first start with you. First of all, tell us what prompted Iran's leader to make the comments that he made in his most recent speech. What was the content of his speech on that matter? But first, what prompted him to actually make those comments, you think?
Well, obviously, the leader is not happy with the tape that was leaked. Of course, as you know, the foreign minister says that this was a private tape. It was not supposed to be publicized or published. But saying these things is something that it's basically contrary to Iran's constitution. We have in Article 176 of the constitution that the system of making policy on foreign issues, foreign policy issues, or security issues is laid out, and Iran's National Security Council has 12 members. 12 members. The foreign minister is a member of Iran's National Security Council and has one vote out of 12. So the suggestion that every time the foreign policy of the country should be in line with what the foreign minister thinks is not really based on Iran's constitution. And as far as I know, in no other country you have a situation where the foreign minister makes all foreign policy decisions. Generally, in many countries, you have a setup like the National Security Council, and the country's president or head of the government or head of the country, and the councils that exist at higher levels engage in policy making, and the foreign ministry is supposed to implement the policies, and so asking more than that would be a little too much. And the remarks generally were not welcomed. even Iran's president, who appointed Iran's foreign minister, was critical of what he heard. And then we had the speech yesterday that was basically saying that the mistake was made in making these remarks, and that's what Ayatollah Khamenei said.
Okay, we're not after, I guess, vilification of the foreign minister, but in this case, Mostafa Khoshesh, looking at how Iran's leader has come out, and as our guest there described, for example, how the foreign ministry, in terms of the institution itself, what role it plays. And there were some other matters also. Can you please give us your synopsis of what Iran's leader has said on those matters?
Hello, Fabian. Thanks for having me. Well, foreign policy, not just in Iran, but anywhere in the world, foreign policy objectives are set and achieved as a product of power, the power that's generated by the country in various sectors, in all areas, in soft areas, in semi-hard and hard areas. That is to say, in some areas like theater, cinema, books, culture, art, as well as media, especially media power and media outlets play in this regard. Also in semi-hard areas like economy plays a very important and vital role in advancing your foreign policy agenda and achieving its goals. Like when the U.S. failed to subdue Iran through military means and avoided that, they went after sanctions as and political and economic, actually, leverage in order to contain Iran's power, Iran's growing power in the region, and the missile industry, and the nuclear industry, and Iran's overall power. So they used the economic leverage, and they are still using it. And also in hard areas, the military also plays a significant role in generating power. All these areas, all the power that the country can generate, helps you achieve your foreign policy agenda. Therefore, all people responsible or officials and sectors responsible for these areas, they should also contribute a role when you describe your foreign policy agenda and goals. And in this, the foreign minister also plays a role. He, no matter it's Zarif or anyone else, he also contributes a share when designing and describing and producing this foreign policy agenda of your country. But he is not the only one. Sometimes his role is bigger than others, sometimes it's smaller. And the foreign ministry actually is tasked with, as Dr. Izadi said, is tasked with implementing the agenda mainly, and the foreign policy, the official in charge, I mean, Mr. Zarif, and the foreign minister actually, is one of the team that decide the foreign policy agenda of the country. If you know how to play in this team, then you may advance your country's foreign policy agenda. If sometimes you miscalculate, then you might be in trouble, and the country would be in trouble. Now, as Mr. Zarif played a bigger role in the JCPOA, in the nuclear deal, when designing this strategy or policy, he had a smaller role in the region. Why? Because the United States, the forefront of the United States in this Middle East region or West Asia region, comes from its military. The U.S. CENTCOM has the first and the last say in this region on behalf of the U.S., although it's not very clearly on the surface, it's not involved anymore in this region. It shouldn't be, actually, after the two wars in this region, and ever since militants started the war in this region, they called for a coalition against ISIL. But actually, that proxy warfare was the result of the U.S. hidden agenda. Yes, covertly, they were involved, but covertly, they were not actually to be in this part of the war. Still, you hear a lot from the CENTCOM commander, General McKenzie, and it's 10 times more than the statements and remarks made by U.S. ambassadors to the Persian Gulf Arab states or other Arab states in this region, the Middle East states. There's a reason for that, because the main role on behalf of the U.S. is played in this region by their military. Therefore, as they have targeted Iran in this region, Iran's military should also be in the forefront, and it should be the first and main player in this area. But okay. In the outside world, when it comes to Europe or Far East, you could see that Zarif is on the forefront very naturally.
All right, well, let's break that open, Fuadizadeh, if I may ask you to do that for us, because there were references made to the Quds Force of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps. Tell us what the Quds Force is, and tell us the role that it has played in terms of policies that have been exercised, especially in the West Asia region.
Well, Quds Force is a branch of the Islamic Republic Guards Corps, and it's a military unit that is charged with engaging outside Iran's border generally. When the threats, when the problem, for example, in Syria, when we had ISIS, the Syrian government asked Iran for help, it was the Quds Force that was present there. When we had a similar problem in Iraq, it was the Quds Force that went to Iraq. So this is what Quds Force does. What General Soleimani did was also he engaged in political issues that dealt with security matters in this part of the world. And he became very good at it. I was watching a webinar by a U.S. Senator, Chris Murphy, the other day. This is a webinar that happened last week. And he was saying that General Soleimani was the most powerful man in the Middle East, which is actually true. So because of what General Soleimani was able to do, the Quds Force was more than just a military force. So he engaged in diplomacy. He met with politicians. In fact, when he went to Iraq on the night that he was assassinated, he was supposed to meet with Iraq's prime minister the next day. So in the recent years in Islamic Republic's foreign policy, regional issues, things that deal with Iran's neighbors, are generally the task of the Quds Force, whether it is military related or even diplomatic issues are generally the domain of the Quds Force. And then the foreign ministry has other tasks. For example, the nuclear talks is something that General Soleimani was not very much a part of. It was Dr. Zarif and the foreign ministry individuals that dealt with that portfolio. So the way the system of foreign policy making in Iran works is that after a decision is made in the National Security Council, then an entity gets that profile and is the lead organization for that profile. So JCPOA, it was the foreign ministry, regional issues, generally the Quds Force, and they are basically helping each other when it comes to achieving foreign policy goals. And one reason Dr. Zarif's comments were criticized was that some people seem to feel that he thought that there's a competition between the two, which is something that's detrimental to a country's foreign policy when different parts of an entity start competing with each other, and that's why people criticize what he said.
Do you agree with that? If I can ask you that similar stuff, Khoshesh, in terms of how the different branches of the country need to work in unison with each other and not feel like they should be in competition with each other?
Yeah, definitely. As I said earlier, foreign policy agenda and achieving its goals could only happen as a result of interaction among different branches of power and different bodies in a state within a team. That's why at the Supreme National Security Council, you have representatives of not just the foreign ministry, but you also have representatives from the economic sector, the guy in charge of budget and planning organization is there, and has a vote, and also from the security sector, the military sector, from the political sector, from different, and also heads of branches of power, head of the judiciary, head of the parliament, head of the government. Actually, President Rouhani, the president of the country, heads the National Security Council of the country. So it's a team, and all the time they should work with each other. In some specific geographies, because of developments like the Middle East, where military developments have left a great impact on anything, everything in this region, one of the team members should be upfront and others should help. And vice versa, in some others, you need to work on your foreign relations and diplomacy, then others would help you. This is decided, actually, in this team, and it should be practiced by everyone. Therefore, there shouldn't be any kind of competition. I do believe that what Mrs. Zarif was talking about is that there is a standard for the support that others would render to one of these team members. And that level standard is decided by the Supreme National Security Council and the leader, and especially the SNSC. And what Zarif wanted was more than what has been already decided by the team. Like, let me give you an example. After the JCPOA, a dozen U.S. Marines trespassed Iranian waters on two boats, and they were arrested by the IRGC Navy forces based on international rules and regulations and according to the Constitution and the right of self-defense, and their duty is to do so exactly. But after they captured these Americans, because Mr. Zarif requested, they released these American trespassers after a few days. And if it hadn't been for Mr. Zarif and the JCPOA, I believe they would have been kept in Iran for years. I mean, those Marines. So I believe Iran has already, I mean, the other team members have already rendered enough help to the foreign ministry. You know, you shouldn't sacrifice your powers, like your military power in this region in the Middle East, for the sake of interest in another part of the world. And that should never be expected. It's not a one-man show. This is the problem, I think, that should be resolved. It's not just about Mrs. Zarif. It should be understood by anyone who wants to go and head the foreign ministry. It doesn't make any difference. We need to understand this, that it's not a one-man show. It's a team, and you should be part of the team. And you should never try to be, you know, more radiant than others, if I may put that this way. Anyway, I believe that Mr. Zarif is now thinking more about it. It's a technical issue, I believe, and it has happened, and it's nothing, you know. When such a thing happens in other countries, they either continue the work and they do the apology and they deal with it through expert views and discussions, or if it's very, you know, troublesome, then they resign. It's nothing specific. If you see that it's talked about and discussed so much internally within the country, because it's an election issue, actually. It's a partisan issue. And we are approaching the election season, so it's discussed under much discussion. But outside, because the Americans want to make something out of it in order to discourage Iranians and say that if the JCPOA has proved to be a failure already, it's not because of the Americans defying the sanctions, it's because of you yourself.
Okay. Well, in conclusion, let me ask you, if I may, Fuadizadeh. So we're looking at a region in which Iran has proven itself to be a major force. I believe that there's no denying that, because it's pretty much echoed all over the place from the West, the Western countries, to you name it. How would you assess the way that Iran has executed itself in terms of not only the region but the world, but in particular, obviously, the West Asia region where it's located?
And, you know, Iran's foreign policy is affected severely by what happened in Iran in 1979, the Islamic Revolution. And when you read Iran's constitution, you see this desire by the people who wrote the constitution to make sure that the principles of Islam are implemented, whether it's domestic policy or international policy. And so there is this duty for the country to engage in activities that are dictated by the teachings of Islam. And this is what Ayatollah Khamenei is tasked with. He's the leader of the country. He's supposed to make sure that the country's constitution is fully implemented. And this is why he objected to what he heard in that tape, because it seemed that some of these objectives in terms of Iran's regional policy is not fully understood or believed by the country's foreign minister.
Okay.
And so this is the issue that Iran has been dealing with, and Iran continues to grow in the last 40 years and learn from the past mistakes and hopefully improve on its policy in the future.
Very well. Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. Fouad Azadi, university professor and political analyst, and Sayyid Mostafa Khoshesh, thank you so much, political analyst. That brings us to an end for this edition of The Debate. From Mikhail Vitakwe, the entire team in the capital, Tehran, just goodbye until next time.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ارزش ها و صفاتی که انسان احترام میگذاره همه این ارزش ها در علی ابن ابی طالب جمعه.
Human in general, whether a Muslim, non-Muslim, or even a disbeliever, respect the values present in the character of Ali ibn Abi Talib.
لا يقيم أمر الله سبحانه إلا من لا يصانع ولا يضارع ولا يتبع المطامع.
Imam Ali عليه السلام, the reason we love him as our hero, or not only in the material sense, in the spiritual sense, in the leadership sense.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program's to my brother, and I'm your host, Mehdi. We're talking about the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. Imam Ali alayhi salam, the most distinguished and extraordinary personality in Islam after the Holy Prophet Muhammad. His entire life is a struggle for the advancement of Islam, the universal religion prescribed by Allah for all of humanity. Imam Ali alayhi salam was the living miracle raised up by the Holy Prophet Muhammad himself, and was not only the successor and the executor of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, but as history testifies, he was also a great human being, a brave defender of Islam, a just and fair judge, a generous philanthropist, a champion of the people, and the most pious person of his time.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of To My Brother. My name is Muhammad. After returning from the Battle of Siffin, Imam Ali gave certain pieces of advice to one of his sons. Historians consider him to be Imam Hassan alayhi salam, while others are of the opinion that he was Muhammadul Hanafiyya. He wrote this letter in the form of a will. They deal with almost every aspect of life, which goes a long way to make a man successful in life, brave, humane, generous, virtuous, and pious. Today, I'm going to read to you an excerpt from the last will of Imam Ali alayhi salam. Please stay with us. My dear son, develop the habit of patience against sufferings, calamities, and adversities. This virtue of patience is one of the highest values of morality and nobility of character, and it is the best habit which one can develop. Trust in Allah and let your mind seek His protection in every calamity and suffering, because you will thus entrust yourself and your affairs to the best trustee and to the mightiest guardian. Do not seek help or protection from anybody but Allah. Reserve your prayers, your requests, your solicitations, your supplications, and your entreaties to Him and Him alone, because to grant, to give, to confer and to bestow, as well as to withhold, to deprive, to refuse, and to debar, lies only in His power. ask as much of his blessings and seek as much of his guidance as you can. Try to understand my exhortation. Ponder over them deeply. Do not take them lightly, and do not turn away from them, because the best knowledge is that which benefits the listener. The knowledge which does not benefit anybody is useless, not valuable, and not worth learning and remembering. My dear son, when I realized that I was getting old, and when I felt that weakness and feebleness are gradually creeping into me, then I hastened to advise you as to the best ways of leading a noble, virtuous, and useful life. I hated the idea that death should overtake me before I tell you all that I wanted to tell, or before my mental capacities, like my bodily strength, are weak.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's great to have you with us. This is IRIB English Radio, the program's to my brother. We're discussing the universal persona of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, alayhi salam. One of the great lessons which we learn from the universal persona of Imam Ali is how one should refrain from running after the dunya, running after the materialistic wealth and the materialistic world. Imam Ali, alayhi salam, used to say, "O yellow gold and white silver, deceive someone else and set the trap on the way of others." So one day, Imam Ali, who had prepared his special sword for selling, he went to the market saying, "Who will buy this sword? By Allah, who makes the grain grow in the earth, this sword has long served the messenger of Allah, and removing the dust of sorrow from his holy face. If I could afford to buy one piece of clothing, I would never sell this sword." Allahu Akbar, dear friends. So profound here that despite the fact that Imam Ali alayhi salam was in need, still he did not beg anyone for the world. He did not beg the world for the world. And so we too must be honest in our work, honest in our dealings, honest in earning a halal, a permissible livelihood. And of course, we should never fall into the trap of falling in love with the materialistic world, because falling in love with the materialistic world truly has no benefit to us, neither in this world nor in the next. A beautiful and profound lesson brought to all of us by the universal persona of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
يوم لا ينفع مال ولا Allah, I ask you for the protection on the day when property will not avail, nor sons except he who comes with a heart free from evil.